Talk with Dr. Ross Walker.
It's the time of the week that we catch up with our good mate, Dr. Ross Walker. Hello, Ross. I trust you well.
I'm very well, thanks, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
A couple of questions from listeners. We spoke yesterday as a result of a story that appeared in the Telegraph. We talked about COVID, and there was a story warning people that COVID is around. There are increasing numbers of people coming down with COVID. I think in the last week there were 6,550, and I made the point that's people that are actually telling the authorities that they have COVID. I imagine there'd be many, many more out there that aren't saying anything. Frederica says, can you ask Dr. Ross if he would recommend getting a booster COVID shot? She said, I'm booked for Wednesday, but now I'm wondering if I should.
Look, I still believe we've got to look at what the current COVID strains are doing, as opposed to quote the Donald, the initial China virus, which was the Wuhan strain. Now, the Wuhan strain had a 3% mortality rate. No one was really had much of an exposure to COVID, obviously because it was a new virus, and so therefore it was killing people left, right, and centre. But these new strains are down to about a 0.2% mortality rate, which is a bit more than the common cold and a bit less than standard influenza. Now, would people get vaccinated? Would an otherwise healthy person get vaccinated against the common cold? I wouldn't, for something that hangs around for 3 months. So the vaccination ability of the RNA vaccines, which have still, there's still a lot of people out there. I know there's probably some anti-vaxxers listening who are just sort of steam's coming out of their forehead, even though the fact we're talking about this at all. But there are still some questions over the potential side effects of the RNA vaccines. And I've just seen two people in here from the beautiful Port Stephens area who both had an injection with Pfizer, and a few weeks later had severe inflammatory pain in their joints, which settled down after a few months. So these things aren't harmless. And so what I'm saying is, in my view still, and I spoke to a top infectious diseases expert on my show about this a couple of weeks ago, still, even despite the fact we're seeing a jump up in COVID cases, I believe the only people who should be vaccinated are the very old, so probably older than 85, the very sick with other conditions, so you've got multiple other medical conditions, but you're younger, or the very overweight. Because we do know beyond a doubt that COVID really loves people who are carrying extra weight. And there's been, in the US, for example, three times the rate of mortality in the African-American population and in the Spanish population, sorry, the Mexican population, compared to Caucasians. And a lot of that, the reason for that is the extra obesity in those populations, because people with darker skin tend to be more insulin resistant, therefore carry more weight. So it's still my view. Am I going to have another COVID vaccine? No, not at the moment, because I'm not very old, I'm not very sick, and I'm not overweight. So I just think we should be sensible about this.
There you go, Freddie. I hope you have some clarification now. Graham says, could you please ask Dr. Ross Walker, I have recently had a calcium score test, which came back at zero. I'm 51. When should I schedule a follow-up calcium score test?
5 years.
There you go.
And look, if he's 51 with a zero calcium score, if his cholesterol is elevated, he should not be treated. Everyone should follow healthy lifestyle principles, no addictions, good sleep, good eating and less of it, 3 to 5 hours of exercise, and most importantly, happiness. But when your calcium score is zero, there's a thing we say in cardiology now, the power of zero. If you have a zero calcium score at the age of 51, regardless of any other risk factors, his 10-year risk for a heart attack is probably 1 to 2%. So just say it's 1%. Taking a statin will lower his risk by 20%. 20% of 1% is 0.2%. So he goes from 1% to 0.8% over 10 years. Why would you bother?
Yeah, true.
But it's really important to follow lifestyle principles.
Lorraine says, a question for Dr. Ross. I have a problem with my stomach / gut suddenly swelling. Lorraine says, this is a daily occurrence and is triggered by arm movement. A stomach gastroscope search and two colonoscopies haven't revealed anything other than polyps, nor have CT scans or ultrasounds. The specialist washed his hands of me, saying I have a lazy bowel. My food intake has always been low, so excess eating hasn't caused it. My own GP says she has no idea, nor has she seen the condition before. Help.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky one. I usually have an answer for most things, but this one I'm struggling a bit just when I'm hearing the story. But a person that is getting swollen gut with arm movement, I'm not sure how the arm movement could in any way be related to that. But can I also say that I make the point here that I don't think there's anyone living in our modern world who doesn't have a degree of gut dysbiosis, which is having a defective gut microbiome. And it could be, in Lorraine's case, that whenever this thing started, something happened to the bacteria in her gut, and she now has defective gut bacteria. So what I would say, before she has any more tests, because obviously she's been thoroughly evaluated by experts who can find nothing wrong with her, but they don't typically do an analysis of the gut microbiome, nor can they interpret that anyhow, because the problem with having a stool specimen done and checking it for your gut microbiome, all that's really telling you is what's in the stool at that particular time. And it's a bit like the gut microbiome is a bit like a native forest. You go into a native forest, you might find some vegetation in one bit of the forest that's not in another bit of the forest. So what I say to everybody, we should be all having 2 or 3 pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables per day, and a very high quality probiotic. Now, the problem is I'm not allowed to say on air what is a high quality probiotic, because the TGA will come down on me like a ton of bricks. Doctors are not allowed to endorse any sort of specific product publicly, which I think is ridiculous, by the way, mate, because when a sportsman or a celebrity endorses a product, their understanding of that product is how quickly the ink dries in the contract they've signed. They have no understanding of actually how the thing works. I do, but I'm not allowed to say it. So there are 2 or 3 very high quality probiotics. If anyone wants to know what they are, they can send you on an email, and I'm happy to give her the names, but I'm not allowed to say them on air.
No, you're not. So I was wondering, do you want to send them to me in a text after we have finished our conversation? And somehow, I will just happen to raise them a little later this afternoon.
All right. Sounds like a good plan.
Fantastic. Yep. Let's talk. So thank you for answering those questions. And as we say, there are more, but let's get stuck into the topics today. If you've got any questions for Dr. Ross, send them to us via email. Coffee. To coffee or not to coffee? Are there any downsides in drinking coffee? Well, there's a new study. 80,000 Dutch people confirmed that coffee keeps our kidneys healthy.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you a question, Brent. Do you know why most of the famous painters were Dutch?
No.
Because they were born in Holland. I would have thought that was obvious. Okay. Now, anyhow, this is and look, I heard a beauty I told on the radio the other night, which is just so funny, I've got to say. When is the worst time to have a heart attack?
No idea.
When you're playing charades. Okay, let's get back onto the topic here. So this is a study of 80,000 Dutch people.
Emergency room. That's what you do. Hey, what? You're going to an emergency room. I can just see it. Sorry.
Yeah, it's hilarious. So anyhow, 80,000 Dutch people looked at their coffee intake and found that going up to 4 cups of coffee a day, and I would have 2 cups, I don't know how much you'd have, but up to 4 cups of coffee a day actually improves kidney function. So this is just falling on the background of more evidence about the benefits of coffee, and this improvement in kidney function is even better in diabetics and people who've had a prior heart attack. But a lot of the studies are now showing that a couple of cups of coffee a day reduces your risk for gallstones, kidney stones, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, many common cancers, type 2 diabetes I just mentioned, heart failure, depression. So I wouldn't see having a couple of cups of coffee a day as a nasty indulgence. I'd see it as medical therapy, and I actually believe it should be seen as a health food in low doses. But is there a downside? Yes, there is a downside. You have more than 6 a day, 6 or more a day, you increase your risk for a heart attack 20%.
Do you?
Because it's too much stimulant, too much caffeine in there.
You do a really good radio show because you talk like this all the time.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
You go, good afternoon, Dr. Ross Walker. How are you?
Yeah. And you're hyped up and you're anxious. And also, too much can also induce osteoporosis. So right. it's best to get the balance here, and the balance is 2 to 3 cups of coffee a day.
Let's talk quality. What about, you know, 2 to 3 cups? Are we talking about any coffee, or are we talking yeah. about, you know, a proper coffee rather than a cup of instant coffee?
No, well, the studies have been done. I think 20 years ago, instant coffee was pretty shonky. The worst one was decaffeinated instant coffee 20 years ago because it had a thing in it which has been taken out now called cavastol that actually put up your cholesterol. So that was dodgy. But now the coffee companies have really tightened their act up. And so even instant coffee, and all these studies are done on people who not the latte sippers, but they're just done on people who drink coffee at home. So right. it's just generally coffee or people that go to I am a latte sipper, by the way, but people who do go to coffee shops. So I don't have a coffee machine at home. I will not drink instant coffee. I just don't like the taste. So I will just have a couple of flat whites or lattes every day. And that's what I do as a benefit. But it doesn't matter whether you like instant coffee or whether you prefer to get it from a cafe. It still has the same health benefit. Whether there's milk in it, whether it's black, it doesn't matter.
Thalidomide for reoccurring bleeding. Reoccurring bleeding and thalidomide for gastrointestinal bleeding. Tell us more about this.
Well, this is the thing. I've got a thing on my show called The Weird File.
Yeah.
And on The Weird File, I just bring up weird things. So you and I remember, because we're about the same age, the thalidomide story from many, many years ago that William McBride exposed. And what happened was that when women were pregnant with severe morning sickness, they used to treat them with thalidomide. But if they took the thalidomide on day 42 post-conception, many of them had little babies born without proper arm development. It's called phocomelia. It was horrible. And so thalidomide died a quick death, as it probably should have back then, for that particular condition. Well, it definitely should have. But then, in the last 10 years, it's re-emerged as a treatment for myeloma. So thalidomide and one of the spin-offs of it called lanalidomide is used for myeloma. But this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine just the other week, that 5 to 10% of gastrointestinal bleeds are due to a thing called angiodysplasia of the small bowel, and up to now we've had no treatment for it. So I don't know how they figured this out, but they found that if they gave different doses of thalidomide to people who had this recurrent GI bleeding, it markedly reduced their risk for further bleeds. And the side effects in older people with this condition, because angiodysplasia tends to occur in people who are well over the age of 50, so it's not as if you're going to give it to premenopausal women who possibly could get pregnant. So this is a very safe drug for older people, and it seems to reduce the risk for gastrointestinal bleeding, which up to now we haven't been able to treat this angiodysplasia.
Hence, it's in the weed file.
Yeah, it's weird.
Is it melanin? Melanin. Super melanin. Melanin heals skin injuries.
This is even better than standard melanin. This is super melanin. And what melanin is the basic skin pigmentation. So someone with darker skin, mm-hmm. as opposed to we white Caucasians, have a huge amount of melanin in their skin, which protects them against the sun.
Right.
So what these researchers did was take melanin and synthesized it into super melanin. They got this human skin tissue, had a blistering reaction to the tissue in a Petri dish, and then applied the super melanin to it a few hours after the injury, and it had a marked effect at healing the damage. And so, and this is a bit weird as well. They dyed a military uniform black with melanin, and it absorbed nerve gas, and it also absorbs heavy metals and toxins, and is possibly good for radiation burns. So it could be that some stage in the very near future, this super melanin is put in suntan lotions. It's used for burn, all sorts of burns, whether they're chemical burns or fire burns or heat burns, and for radiation poisoning. So it could have a vast array of different benefits. So I just thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, the future is exciting. Are you truly healthy? Well, up until a couple of years ago, I would have answered yes, but now, holy smokes, that's a big question mark. This is interesting. Are you truly healthy?
Well, I am taking this from my favourite magazine that I read every week is New Scientist. If people are interested in science, as I clearly am, you should read New Scientist because it's a great magazine. It's got everything. It's got physics, it's got chemistry, and it's got a lot of stuff about medicine. So one of the articles in it, which I thought was fantastic, Are You Truly Healthy? And it's interesting. The World Health Organization defines health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease. Can you find somebody who can say they're truly healthy?
I was going to say there wouldn't be anyone with that, would it?
Hardly anyone with that criteria. But what they're talking about is just different things to look at. So firstly, look at your BMI. Look at how much weight you're carrying. Look at your blood pressure. And I say with people checking their blood pressure, you should sit quietly in a room by yourself for 5 minutes, never first thing in the morning. So 10 o'clock one week, maybe 3 o'clock the next week, 9 o'clock the next week if you're checking your blood pressure. See what it's doing, and it should be sitting at 120 on 80. What I do in my own practice, I also have a very flash technique that I put a little thing over the wrist, and it measures central blood pressure, which is more accurate, and general arterial stiffness. That's number two. Number three, we've already spoken about it. Look at the microbiome, and as we get better at testing the microbiome, we'll have a much better feel for what is healthy and what's an unhealthy microbiome. Then they talk about a thing called the metabolome, and the metabolome is looking at all the different metabolic parameters in your body, such as what's your fat profile doing, cholesterol, triglyceride, HDL, what's your sugar doing, your blood sugar, hemoglobin A1C, what's your liver function doing. All these aspects of metabolism are so important at determining health, estimating your biologic age. So we now have different techniques to figure out how biologically old someone is as opposed to how chronologically old they are, and doing that. Immune resilience. Now, this is a really interesting one because you've, of course, heard of T-cells. Everyone's heard of T-cells since COVID's come out. T-cells are really important for how you respond to things like viruses and cancers. And so they can measure different components of T-cells called CD4 and CD8 and look at the ratio to tell whether you've got immune resilience or not. Then finally, mental health. You now can do any online test to gauge your happiness, your sleep, your anxiety, ADHD, depression, addiction, and eating disorders. And then this is the final bit of the article, 5 quick ways to judge your health.
This is good. Everyone can do this.
Yeah, everyone can do this. Look in the mirror. So look in the mirror. Does your skin look good? Are you getting wrinkles? Because interestingly, wrinkles are not just an example of old age. They can promote aging as well because the skin is the second biggest organ in the body after the endothelium, the lining of blood vessels. And so if your skin's wrinkled, you're having more senescent cells, which are aging you. Number two, get a grip. Test your grip strength. Number three, count the amount of colds you have per year. So one to two colds per year is average for most humans. But if you're having 3 or 4 or 5 as an adult, that's not good. Number four, think about yesterday. What was your belt size today compared with what it was a few months ago? How you're sleeping today compared with how you were a few months ago? And number five, finally, just how do you generally feel? Do you generally feel energetic? Do you have a good mood? Do you enjoy your life? Do you have good sleep? All of those questions. And that's a good indication of how healthy you are.
Come back to this grip thing. Why get a grip?
Yeah, because there's a lot of studies now showing that the better your grip strength, the longer you live, the less cardiovascular disease you have. Because grip strength is a good indication of your general muscle strength. And muscle strength, and I always talk about when you're exercising, it should be 2/3 cardio, 1/3 resistance training. Because if you have poor muscle strength, you tend to have what we call sarcopenia, which is loss of muscle bulk. And if you don't have good muscle bulk, you're not protecting your bones, you can't do good quality exercise, a lot of bad things, you then become frail, which is not a good thing to become.
Does this mean we all rush out to our local Rebel store and buy, one of those grip things that you see people gripping to tighten and build their strength in their wrists?
I don't have a problem with that at all, or do what I do every day, which is I do moderate-sized weights just to keep the muscles going in the arms, which obviously helps the grip strength as well. So weights or something like that. I also have a very strong band that I got from Kmart that I just pull up every day to keep my grip strength going and to keep my biceps working. So I think we all should be doing that.
Good. AstraZeneca. We've been talking about COVID this afternoon. It's come out that the AstraZeneca vaccine claimed to be defective in a landmark legal case.
Yeah, and look, can I say, having now all of us been through COVID, and there's still, as we just spoke about at the start of the show, there's more COVID still hanging around, I still think AstraZeneca was the best vaccine we had, in my view. But a few people who were affected by the AstraZeneca vaccine are now suing AstraZeneca and Oxford University because of this vaccine-inducing clotting. Now, let me give you the numbers. 2 to 3 people per 100,000 who were given the AstraZeneca vaccine had this thrombosis with thrombocytopenia, was the clotting from the AstraZeneca. And what happens is that vaccine affects a thing called platelet factor 4, one of the factors that make the platelets, little sticky elements, clot together and give you clots. But there's a condition, Brent, called antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, which occurs in about 50 per 100,000 people. And it's my hypothesis that, strangely, no one's investigated, that the people who got the clotting from the AstraZeneca vaccine had this underlying antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, mm-hmm. and that the vaccine just stirred up the condition and made them clot. Because the vast majority of people who didn't get the clotting from AstraZeneca clearly didn't have this antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. And I've had a few personal cases, which is why I'm suggesting this, of people who had known antiphospholipid antibody syndrome before we realized the clotting problem with AstraZeneca, who then came down with the clots because of their underlying antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. So it's a bit like, I say that, make the point, you get in a plane from here to Heathrow, you come up with a big economy syndrome with a big swollen leg at the end of it, you want to sue Qantas, you should be suing your relatives for giving you the genes that thickened your blood.
Yeah, very true. So if you read in the newspapers in the next couple of days bad things about the AstraZeneca vaccine, don't worry too much.
No. Look, if you've had AstraZeneca 2 or 3 years ago, because it's now off the market, it's not going to come back and bite you on the bum. And I think most people who had the clotting had this antiphospholipid antibody syndrome.
Okay, time is up. Thank you so much. It's always good to talk to you. You're brilliant, and we're very fortunate to be able to talk to you each and every week.
I'm very fortunate to have you as one of my best mates, so that's fine.
We'll talk next week, and I suppose it's getting closer to Christmas. Are you going away for Chrissy?
Oh, absolutely. Just doing that. I'm having a month off radio from end of December to all of January, and then be back in February. So we've still got a few more weeks to go.
Look forward to it. Talk to you next week.
Thanks, mate.
You too, mate. Bye-bye. That's Dr. Ross Walker.